You know that hit song on the radio, the one that sort of sounds like that other hit song you also love? Well, it may not be a coincidence that they are so similar. Much of the music we consume, at least in the world of Top 40, is created by a small number of producers. The New Yorker's John Seabrook explores what it takes to make one of those hits today in his article in the most recent issue of the magazine. It's called The Song Machine, and I'm very pleased to welcome John Seabrook back to our show today. Hello.
Thanks, Leonard. Nice to be here.
You're right that we're a long way from Cole Porter because of the way songs are created today.
Yeah, I mean, even the components of songs. People think about writing songs, it's usually a lyricist and a composer. So there's the words and the music, and two different people do them. That's changed. The producers do the what's called the track, which is essentially the beats and the sort of musical bed. And then there are these people called top line writers who come in and create the, not even all the lyrics, but the hook, which is sort of the melodic essence of the song. So even though in copyright law, you can only copyright either the melody or the lyrics, nowadays, the way they're made, the songs don't conform to copyright laws. It would be difficult to copyright some of these components because they're neither music nor lyrics. They're kind of beats and synths and ambience.
And that's the stuff that used to be added on later when
right.
you were trying to figure out how you wanted to make the record. But the music industry has always been a kind of a machine, hasn't it? Going all the way back to Tin Pan Alley and then with the songwriters who worked in the Brill Building, and Geffen and Neil Sedaka, Ellie Greenwich.
Absolutely. I think coming out of the rock and folk era where there was an emphasis placed on the singer-songwriter, you know, Dylan being the archetype on the folk side and then Beatles and the Stones and so forth on the rock side, we got to thinking that, oh, yes, well, the artists are the ones that write the songs, and that's kind of what being an artist sort of means is writing as well as singing. But in fact, there's a much longer tradition of specialized writers and singers, and they do different things.
But I would think people have a resistance to thinking about music as a product like potato chips and soda, which is what you're saying it has become in many instances.
There is a resistance to it, and the music industry spends a fair amount of time trying to sort of build up the illusion that it isn't potato chips, that it's coming from the heart because a song.
You mean Beyonce is writing these songs?
Well, she gets a credit on a lot of the songs. A lot of songwriters, and there's a long tradition there going back to Elvis, giving the artist, the singer, songwriting credit, even when they do almost nothing to write the song, because that's part of the atmosphere, the reputation of being an artist.
So we're not seeing somebody just fiddling around at the piano or on a guitar and coming up with some kind of melody and a song coming out of that?
It's funny. I spent 5 days in the studio and not a single instrument was touched. I would wager that in 95% of the top 40 songs you hear on the radio nowadays, no one ever plays an instrument. They're all made on machines.
Now, we started off the show with a song by Rihanna. How many people might work on putting together one hit song for her?
Often Rihanna, because she doesn't write her songs either, has camps, writer camps, where they get together, you know, lots of writers and producers for a week, and usually in Los Angeles, from all around the world, bring people in, and everybody just kind of brainstorms on songs, and out of that come, you know, maybe 30 or 40 songs, and then Rihanna gets to choose which ones to put on her record. So if you look at her record, look at the last one, there's maybe four or five different producers and maybe four or five different top line writers who have created tracks for this album.
When we hear about Adele becoming such a sensation, it's all based on the fact that her hit song was personal, it was autobiographical.
Although it wasn't
Can we say that about Rihanna?
Should
we?
It wasn't entirely written by her. She worked with a producer, too. But yes, it comes from personal experience. Rihanna's songs, I think, are pure fantasy. That's part of what she offers, is this fantasy of often a powerful, sexually adventurous woman who, you know, is going to stand up for her own pleasure.
In a way, isn't this a more efficient way to produce music? In the old days, you'd get these musicians together in a recording studio, which cost a lot of money.
Right.
And then they would work things out. Sometimes it would take a day or so to come up with one track.
Or longer. And the other word there is it's a lot cheaper this way. And the music industry doesn't have the bucks they used to have to spend on studios. And the technology has changed, too. So they used to have to go to a studio to get this technology. Now it's all available at home on your computer.
So inauthenticity is the standard today?
Well, I don't know if they use it as like a brand of, you know, to admire, but certainly the singer-songwriter is not really all that present on Top 40. And even with people like Taylor Swift, who, you know, sort of everyone knows writes her songs, she gets a lot of help too. So there are certain people who are kind of marketed as singer-songwriters, but that doesn't necessarily mean they write all their own. And Lady Gaga claims to write her own music too, but she gets help from producers. So everyone basically gets help, and some don't write their songs at all.
Since people like Taylor Swift and Lady Gaga seem to be spend an awful lot of time having their hair done and doing all the other things, when did they have time to even write their songs?
Well, that's a good question, and that's why a lot of artists don't write their songs, is because they're touring, you know, all year. And when do they have time? Exactly. They're making videos, they're doing makeup, and they're performing.
The production team that you follow is called Stargate. Who are they?
Right. Stargate are these two Norwegian guys, Tor Hermansen and Mikael Eriksson. They're both 39. They grew up in Norway, which is unlike... A lot of people know that producers come from Sweden, Max Martin being the most famous, and they do have a very sort of active pop scene, but Norway does not. And it has an even less active urban music scene. In fact, these two guys are basically the only two fans of urban music in Norway, and so it was inevitable that they meet, and they form this production duo.
And come here.
They started in London as remixers, which is actually important to their sound. So they would take American R&B hits and then remix them in a kind of European sort of pop way for a play in the UK. And so they made their name first there, and then they came here. And that was in 2005, and they have sort of taken the music scene here by storm, too.
And can you see a European sensibility in their work?
They have a melodic essence, a melodic feeling to their work, which when they arrived, the sort of harder beats of hip-hop producers like Timbaland and the Neptunes were making very sort of linear, beat-oriented music. They came with this kind of choral feeling, this kind of melodic feeling, which wasn't really on the radio when they arrived, but turned out that that's what a lot of the writers and the singers gravitated to. And now you really almost, there's almost a new kind of urban pop that they've created.
So over the years, how many hits on the radio are they responsible? I guess it's not radio anymore, but wherever the hits are become hits, how many are they responsible for?
I think they've had sort of 21 top 10 hits, and they've had a 10 or 11 number ones. Their biggest one probably was Irreplaceable, Beyonce's song from 2007. They've had a couple number ones with Neo, the R&B vocalist. They've had at least three with Rihanna. It's a pretty good track record. There's only a few of that league, Dr. Luke, Max Martin, Stargate. David Guetta is now a big one, but very few.
And they all work pretty much in the same way?
Yeah. Max Martin can also do the top line, so he's kind of unique in that he can do the melodies as well. But most of them work, yeah, producers and writers collaborate.
You note that sometimes producers double dip and two artists decide to record the same song, which happened when Beyonce recorded and released Halo and Kelly Clarkson put out Already Gone. Both songs have essentially the same tracks, don't they?
Yeah, if you listen to both songs, they are, they're the same.
Well, we're going to play them, and we'll take a little break after that, and we'll come back with more. But listen closely. Oh, we can't do it. Okay. They even have the same clapping.
Yep. But, you know, the words do change it quite a bit, too. So it does give it a different feeling.
But does that sameness actually make people more comfortable with the music?
Well, it's funny because when Halo was a hit first... And when Kelly Clarkson heard that song, her song hadn't come out yet, and she actually tried to get the label to pull it because she thought everyone would think, oh, Kelly Clarkson just stole Beyonce's song. But in fact, it was an even bigger hit than Halo. Either they didn't notice or they didn't care. And maybe they liked the fact that they sounded similar.
Well, so much of the music today is from samples, so is the public used to hearing something that's already been heard before?
That's a good point. That's a good point. That's probably true.
Well, let's go to a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the song machine, the hit makers behind Rihanna. It's the article in the current issue of The New Yorker written by John Seabrook. Nicki Minaj's Turn Me On. She isn't produced by Stargate, you say.
No, those tracks were not, but both of those tracks were written. The top line and the hook was written by Esther Dean, who was in my piece, who you can hear, too, singing behind Nicki on the hook there.
When you say the top line, are we talking about melody? Because it's really hard to pick out melodies on any of these songs. A friend of mine challenged her daughter and some friends to sing some of the big hits, and they really were hard-pressed to do it. But then when she asked these young kids if they could sing a few Beatles songs, they knew them all.
Yeah, I think
the words.
Yeah, I know. With the Beatles, the melody can carry you through the whole song. With these songs, they're kind of bursts of melody. It's like they've taken songs, removed all the less than totally riveting parts, and then just taken the riveting parts and put them together. So it's almost like their greatest hits within one single hit.
You know, and I mean? then the human factor seems to be taken out. These are pretty much all done by machines, aren't they?
Well,
we don't have live musicians
out
there possibly making a mistake, which can sometimes lead to a really exciting moment in
music. And the voices
music.
Are all auto-tuned, too. So there's no sort of coming up to the note or a little past the note. All those imperfections that you end up loving about the old vinyl records you have in your collection basically don't exist anymore. They're all gone.
What is autotune exactly?
It's correcting for pitch. It's machine correcting for pitch. So you don't have to sing right on the note. It'll change the pitch of your voice. So everything is square. Usually singers come up to the note and then they're on the note. Whereas with autotuning, it's like a square face right up to the note.
So when Patti LaBelle used to slide up to the song, the note on Danny Boy, we wouldn't have that anymore.
No more sliding up.
It takes a personality out of the music as well.
One of the reasons it's done, and particularly in the studio, is that attitude and what they call swag has become so important in singles these days that they want the singer to be able to put maximum attitude and personality into the songs and not have to worry about hitting the notes. So you can take the take that is the most attitudinal, if you will, and not just the take that's the most on pitch, which used to be the case.
So it's almost like acting rather than singing.
Yeah, well, a lot of it is like acting. I mean, you know, a lot of these singers are like actors in that they're playing a role and a script written by somebody else.
And you mentioned Esther Dean. She doesn't really write it all. She goes into the studio and sort of free associates over the music.
Yeah,
how does that work?
It's a hip-hop tradition, kind of freestyling on the mic. She has a gift. She has a melodic gift, which is freed on the mic. It's not freed by sitting there with a pad and paper alone kind of thinking about it. It needs that kind of spontaneous moment, and then this stuff comes out of her. But those hooks are very catchy, and they're hard. It's not everybody can do that stuff. That's hard to do.
Well, it sounds to me like with all of this correction, Esther Dean could become a big star on her own. At the end of the day, how much money does she make compared to Rihanna?
Well, she makes a lot of money. Hit songwriters, number one song, at least $1 million a year. The Dream, who wrote Umbrella for Rihanna, claims to have made $15 million from Umbrella. So there's a lot of money there to be made from getting played on the radio.
But she has tried to establish her own career, hasn't she?
She is planning. She has tried in a certain fashion, but this is the year of Esther Dean. This is the year that she's really going to take all those songs that she wrote for other people, and she's going to keep them, the new ones, she's going to keep them for herself. And that'll be interesting to see how that goes down.
How does that, someone like Esther Dean even wind up in the business?
Oh, Esther, it's a fantastic story. She was someone from no musical background, no musical training, was dropped out of school, was working as a nurse's aide. And when she was 25, she was at an outdoor concert in Atlanta singing along with a band. And there happened to be a producer who was just in the audience and heard this woman singing and thought, my God, that woman can sing. I've got to find out who that is. And the producer was named Tricky Stewart. And he went and introduced himself to Esther and said, you have to come to my studio and work on songs. And so it was kind of like the Schraff's drugstore story in a way. You know, it was kind of classic.
Well, considering the fact that you have all of these devices to make everybody sound the same, does it really matter whether it's Rihanna or Esther Dean? I mean, Rihanna is a very beautiful woman. Is that the reason she's the star?
Well, certainly looks have a lot to do with it, yes. Looks and the ability to perform and the ability to, you know, carry all that pressure, walk into a room, have everybody look at you. That's a big part of it. But these voices are not all the same. I mean, I think, you know, Beyonce, Rihanna, and Nicki Minaj all have very sort of distinct flavors in their voices, and their music is different too. So yeah, you know, there's differences there.
Well, you say that Rihanna embodies the music and the style of Top 40 the most. Why her of all the people out there?
Well, partly because it's quantity, not quality with Rihanna. I mean, she puts out an album every year. She's always got a hit somewhere in the charts. I mean, it used to be, you know, you sort of like, even Adele says she's not going to put out another album for a couple of years. She's going to wait and think. With Rihanna, there's always a new album in the works while she's out touring around for the last one. And also, she is the one who puts that kind of swagger, I think, more than any other artist, into the music, that attitude and that particularly female fierceness that she has. There's no one quite like her.
But you also say that the artists rarely go into the studio these days?
They don't have time. They're on that on the road. And also, you know, again, the technology is such that you can have all the electronics you need in the van that follows the tour around. In Rihanna's production notes, if you look at the production notes for Talk That Talk, her last album, most of those songs were recorded in hotel rooms.
Or on the bus, you point out.
Or on the bus. I mean, and one of them in particular, it starts on the bus, then it's done in a hotel in London, and it's finished in a hotel in Paris. So, and how do you get a good vocal? I actually saw an interview with her vocal engineer who travels with her, who said they do a lot of their recording at 4 or 5 in the morning. She don't really know how you get the best vocal at 5 in the morning. But
listeners have been writing in. Chris from Westchester, who says he's a professional musician, says that he finds auto-tuners and people singing flat appalling, and the music that's coming out is soulless.
I think auto-tuning is way overdone. I mean, it kind of works in a certain genre. T-Pain is sort of the king of auto-tuning, but it's used so ubiquitously now. I do think there's going to be a backlash. Adele is actually somebody who could really cause a backlash because she's not auto-tuned.
Some people are wondering whether this is all Madonna's fault.
Can we blame it on Madonna? Madonna certainly created a kind of archetype. And Madonna also doesn't write her music, although she sort of owns it in the way like an actress would own a role. So, yeah, we could blame Madonna, I guess.
On the other hand, as you said, Adele, Amy Winehouse is another one who obviously was not auto-tuned. So is this an American thing as opposed to a British thing?
I think, again, there's a lot of hip-hop tradition comes out of American hip-hop and has been now sort of transferred to pop generally. But, yeah, I don't think you hear it as much in Europe.
I was wondering if I were put on the autotune and affected an attitude, could I sound like Beyonce or Rihanna?
Well, you have to have a good voice. I mean, I think a lot of people think that autotune
nice
just
voice.
Makes you sound good if you don't have a good voice. It doesn't. I mean, you still have to have the quality in your voice. But you could certainly be on pitch. And well, that'd be nice. Yeah, me too.
You also talk about songs needing multiple hooks. In the old days, all you needed was one. You know, Jeremiah was a bullfrog, and that kind of was enough.
Again, I think it's part of our sort of ADD culture. The research is that you have to hook somebody in 7 seconds on the radio. If they're listening to a song for more than 7 seconds and you haven't sort of delivered a hook, then they're going to change the channel. So, you know, songs are just stacked with hooks. Hook in the bridge, hook in the chorus, hook in the intro, hook in the verse. The more hooks, the better, you know, because it keeps people from changing the channel.
Well, what about radio today? Does radio still sell songs? You note that the best-selling singles on iTunes sync up almost perfectly with the radio-driven top 40 charts.
And also with the views on YouTube. It's kind of weird that we live in this era where anybody can get any kind of music very simply, very easily over the internet, any kind of music. And yet hits are, if anything, more important than ever, and people gravitate them more strongly than ever. And it's maybe because they have all these choices. There's just sort of a need to be on the same page somewhere, and radio continues to provide that function.
But the record companies are in serious trouble these days. Where is the money coming from?
Well, a lot of record companies, as you know, have gone with, you know, sort of Live Nation type sort of 360 deals where you get money from the record sales, but also from the touring. I mean, the money's in the touring. And the radio even is just promoting the tours. People are going to see the tours to hear the songs that they heard on the radio, even though that brings up an interesting point, because all these songs are made on machines. When you go out on tour, they actually have to play instruments to make them, and it doesn't always really sound, or often sound, the same. And you're a little bit let down, I think, because it's a different kind of a song, because it's made differently. But
although they do have synthesizers and all sorts of other things playing in the background,
right?
And they have
but they always have guys on stage performing something with a guitar.
And we've seen a couple of embarrassing moments on Saturday Night Live because these performers aren't always prepared to do something where the camera comes in real close.
Right. And then you have the whole lip syncing.
Do you think a lot of these people are lip syncing when they're doing their concerts?
I don't know. I don't know for sure, but, you know, it wouldn't be difficult. It's interesting that we
draw
the
line. Well, Milli Vanilli had that big scandal, right? But that was a long time ago. I suspect it would not be a problem today.
We draw the line at lip syncing. Oh, that is too artificial. But we don't draw the line at, you know, artificial instruments or, you know, the way in which the songs are made. But the performance, we sort of want to sort of preserve this kind of pristine quality, too.
You note that record companies will sometimes approach producers like Stargate in the final days before a record is released. Are they afraid that there just isn't enough going on them?
Well, we don't live in an album-oriented industry anymore. I mean, it used to be, you know, you could sell music based on the album, but now it really is all gone back to being about singles. And so if your album doesn't have singles, particularly if you're, you know, one of these sort of top 40 artists, it's not like people are going to just go and buy the album. You know, they want the singles. And maybe they'll buy the album to get the singles, or maybe they'll just buy the singles on iTunes. Then that's why they go to the shows, because they hear the singles on the radio. So you need the singles more than ever.
Daniel asks, is this all that different from what happened when Phil Spector was producing records?
No.
Because he kind of expected his performers to sing it exactly the way he wanted them to sing.
Right. He ran the sessions. It's interesting. There are a lot of parallels with Phil Spector. Girl groups, you sort of words that don't really mean anything, like da-do-ron-ron, which was actually a placeholder for a title when they wrote that song. They said, we don't know the title yet. Let's, for the meantime, call it da-do-ron-ron. And then Spector said, no, you know, that's the title. And, you know, sort of, it's not about meaning and profundity or, you know, sort of burying your soul. It's about having fun, and it's about the sound, maybe more than the song. And I think we've come back to that era again.
A Lady Gaga record, one of my producers tells me, tends to have songs that each seem tailored to specific markets. Is that often the case?
That was a little more specialized than most of the artists that I'm writing about in this piece. But
it sounds to me like market research is now part of the creation of recording.
Well, that's certainly true. And Lady Gaga's kind of unique in that she has a real rock vibe. In even in music that sounds like dance music, there's often a kind. And her last album was, it was very clear that she has this kind of, you know, rock thing. So there is this kind of split in her musical taste that you don't always see in some of the her other artists, other artists who are peers.
Over the past few decades, there's been a major consolidation of the commercial FM radio spectrum. The same, in fact, often you go from town to town, you're hearing pretty much the same broadcast. Do you think that's responsible for this uniformity?
Probably. I mean, a lot of this is like kind of rock and the vacuum left by the decline of rock as a mainstream form. You look at the dial in New York here, you know, so many of the K, what happened to K, I mean, K-Rock, it's a top 40 station now. A lot of the radio stations have gone to top 40 because people sort of stopped listening to rock.
Well, it is interesting that FM initially was seen as an alternative
right.
to top 40 AM radio.
Right.
And DJs were playing a wide range of things. You could hear John Coltrane after you heard a Rolling Stones track or something like that. Now it all just seems to be very formulaic.
The one thing, Leonard, I will say is about Top 40 is that as a format, it is among the most eclectic because it's based on popularity and not based on a musical style. So you can have, you know, a rock song and then a hip-hop song and then a dance song and then an R&B song. There's no other format that I can think of that mixes genres as freely as Top 40 does.
Now, you mentioned that the girl groups are important. Why do you think it is that women dominate these charts?
Again, I think you look at rock. Why was it in rock that that men dominated? There's something about, you know, sort of guys and rock and that stuff that really sort of lasted from the beginning until the end. Whereas when you get more into a pop era and maybe more into a dance type era, it's kind of disco. You know, it's go back and look at disco where women, that was the last time I think women were, you know, dominating the charts. And again, this, in a way, we're kind of, it's like, disco did lose. Disco won, you know, in the long run.
Listeners are pointing out that some of this stuff is not new. Frank Sinatra sometimes sang a little flat, and they used to speed up the tape.
Mm-hmm.
Cher used to have similar things, and they would thicken her voice. Some of those other Philadelphia singers who were Fabian, for example, mm-hmm. they were all pretty much created in the recording studio with overdubs and the like. So this is just the latest version of that,
I think it would be naive to say, oh, the music industry used to be all about authenticity, and now it's all gone, you know, the way of, you know, sort of machine-made stuff. There's always been help and people who have always faked or glossed over certain things. And Sinatra didn't write his songs either, so he was kind of manufactured in a sense too.
Although he had Nelson Riddle, not two Norwegian guys.
Right. Well, we'll talk to the Norwegian guys about that.
John Seabrook's article, "The Song Machine: The Hitmakers Behind Rihanna." Is in the current issue of The New Yorker. Thank you so much for being on
our
show
again,
today.
Thanks again, Leonard.